Chapter 4. Ornament that avenue. Next day, all these scaffoldings were filled with brick and mortar. Presently, over the bricks and mortar rose pediments of statues, legs of urns, legs of goddesses, legs, and bodies of goddesses, legs, bodies, and busts of goddesses. Finally, on the 13th December, goddesses complete. On the 14th they were painted marble color, and the basements of wood and canvas on which they stood were made to resemble the same costly material. The funereal urns were ready to receive the frankincense and precious odors which were to burn in them. A vast number of white columns stretched down the avenue, each bearing a bronze buckler on which was written, in gold letters, one of the victories of the emperor, and each decorated with enormous imperial flags. On these columns golden eagles were placed, and the newspapers did not fail to remark the ingenious position in which the royal birds had been set. For while those on the right-hand side of the way had their heads turned towards the procession, as if to watch its coming, those on the left were looking exactly the other way, as if to regard its progress. Do not fancy I am joking. This point was gravely and emphatically urged in many newspapers, and I do believe no mortal Frenchman ever thought it anything but sublime. Do not interrupt me, sweet Miss Smith. I feel that you are angry. I can see from here the pouting of your lips, and know what you are going to say. You are going to say, I will read no more of this Mr. Titmarsh. There is no subject, however solemn, but he treats it with flippant irreverence, and no character, however great, at whom he does not sneer. Ah, my dear, you are young now and enthusiastic, and your Titmarsh is old, very old, sad, and gray-headed. I have seen a poor mother buy a halfpenny wreath at the gate of Montmartre burying ground, and go with it to her little child's grave, and hang it there over the little humble stone. And if ever you saw me scorn the mean offering of the poor shabby creature, I will give you leave to be as angry as you will. They say that on the passage of Napoleon's coffin down the Seine, old soldiers and country people walked miles from their villages, just to catch a sight of the boat which carried his body, and to kneel down on the shore, and pray for him. God forbid that we should quarrel with such prayers and sorrow, or question their sincerity. Something great and good must have been in this man, something loving and kindly, that has kept his name, so cherished in the popular memory, and gained him such lasting reverence and affection. But, madam, one may respect the dead without feeling awe-stricken at the plumes of the hearse, and I see no reason why one should sympathize with the train of mutes and undertakers, however deep may be their mourning. Look, I pray you, at the manner in which the French nation has performed Napoleon's funeral. Time out of mind, nations have raised, in memory of their heroes, august mausoleums, grand pyramids, splendid statues of gold or marble, sacrificing whatever they had that was most costly and rare, or that was most beautiful in art, as tokens of their respect and love for the dead person. What a fine example of this sort of sacrifice is that recorded in a book, of which simplicity is the great characteristic, of the poor woman who brought her pot of precious ointment her all, and laid it at the feet of the object which, upon earth, she most loved and respected. Economists and calculators there were even in those days who quarreled with the manner in which the poor woman lavished so much capital. But you will remember how nobly and generously the sacrifice was appreciated, and how the economists were put to shame. With regard to the funeral ceremony that has just been performed here, it is said that a famous public personage and statesman, Monsieur Thiers indeed, spoke with the bitterest indignation of the general style of the preparations, and of their mean and tawdry character. He would have had a pomp as magnificent, he said, as that of Rome at the triumph of Aurelian. He would have decorated the bridges and avenues through which the procession was to pass, with the costliest marbles and the finest works of art, and have had them to remain there forever as monuments of the great funeral. The economists and calculators might here interpose with a great deal of reason. For, indeed, there was no reason why a nation should impoverish itself to do honor to the memory of an individual for whom, after all, it can feel but a qualified enthusiasm. But it surely might have employed the large sum voted for the purpose more wisely and generously, and recorded its respect for Napoleon by some worthy and lasting memorial, rather than have erected yonder thousand vain heaps of tinsel, paint, and plaster, that are already cracking and crumbling in the frost, at 3 days old. Scarcely one of the statues, indeed, deserves to last a month. Some are odious distortions and caricatures, which never should have been allowed to stand for a moment. On the very day of the fete, the wind was shaking the canvas pedestals, and the flimsy woodwork had begun to gape and give way. At a little distance, to be sure, you could not see the cracks, and pedestals and statues looked like marble. At some distance, you could not tell, but that the wreaths and eagles were gold embroidery, and not gilt paper the great tricolor flags damask, and not striped calico. One would think that these sham splendors betokened sham respect, if one had not known that the name of Napoleon is held in real reverence, and observed somewhat of the character of the nation. Real feelings they have, but they distort them by exaggeration. Real courage, which they render ludicrous by intolerable braggadocio. And I think the above official account of the Prince de Joinville's proceedings, of the manner in which the Emperor's remains have been treated in their voyage to the capital, and of the preparations made to receive him in it, will give my dear Miss Smith some means of understanding the social and moral condition of this worthy people of France. 3. On the funeral ceremony. Shall I tell you, my dear, that when Francois woke me at a very early hour on this eventful morning, while the keen stars were still glittering overhead, a half moon, as sharp as a razor, beaming in the frosty sky, and a wicked north wind blowing, that blew the blood out of one's fingers, and froze your leg as you put it out of bed. Shall I tell you, my dear, that when Francois called me, and said, V'là votre café, Monsieur Titimus, buvez-le. Teens, il est out chaud, I felt myself, after imbibing the hot breakfast, so comfortable under three blankets and a Macintosh, that for at least a quarter of an hour, no man in Europe could say whether Titmarsh would or would not be present at the burial of the Emperor Napoleon. Besides, my dear, the cold, there was another reason for doubting. Did the French nation, or did they not, intend to offer up some of us English over the imperial grave? And were the games to be concluded by a massacre? It was said in the newspapers that Lord Granville had dispatched circulars to all the English resident in Paris, begging them to keep their homes. The French journals announced this news, and warned us charitably of the fate intended for us. Had Lord Granville written? Certainly not to me. Or had he written to all except me? And was I the victim, the doomed one? To be seized directly I showed my face in the Champs-Élysées, and torn in pieces by French patriotism to the frantic chorus of the Marseillais? Depend on it, madam, that high and low in this city on Tuesday were not altogether at their ease, and that the bravest felt no small tremor. And be sure of this, that as His Majesty Louis Philippe took his nightcap off his royal head that morning, he prayed heartily that he might, at night, put it on in safety. Well, as my companion and I came out of doors, being bound for the Church of the Invalides, for which a deputy had kindly furnished us with tickets, we saw the very prettiest sight of the whole day, and I can't refrain from mentioning it to my dear, tender-hearted Miss Smith. In the same house where I live, but about 5 stories nearer the ground, lodges an English family, consisting of one. A great-grandmother, a hale, handsome old lady of 70, the very best-dressed and neatest old lady in Paris. Two. A grandfather and grandmother, tolerably young to bear that title. Three. A daughter. And four. Two little great-grand, or grandchildren, that may be of the age of 3 and 1, and belong to a son and daughter who are in India. the grandfather, who is as proud of his wife as he was 30 years ago when he married, and pays her compliments still twice or thrice in a day, and when he leads her into a room looks round at the persons assembled, and says in his heart, "Here, gentlemen, here is my wife, show me such another woman in England." This gentleman had hired a room on the Champs-Élysées, for he would not have his wife catch cold by exposing her to the balconies in the open air. When I came to the street, I found the family assembled in the following order of march. Number 1, the great-grandmother walking daintily along, supported by number 3, her granddaughter. A nurse carrying number 4, Junior, who was sound asleep. And a huge basket containing saucepans, bottles of milk, parcels of infant's food, certain dimity napkins, a child's coral, and a little horse belonging to number 4 senior. A servant bearing a basket of condiments. Number 2 grandfather, spick and span, clean shaved, hat brushed, white buckskin gloves, bamboo cane, brown greatcoat, walking as upright and solemn as may be, having his lady on his arm. Number 4 senior, with mottled legs and a tartan costume, who was frisking about between his grandpapa's legs, who heartily wished him at home. "My dear," his face seemed to say to his lady, "I think you might have left the little things in the nursery, for we shall have to squeeze through a terrible crowd in the Champs-Élysées." The lady was going out for a day's pleasure, and her face was full of care. As he had to look first after her old mother who was walking ahead, then after number 4 junior with the nurse, he might fall into all sorts of danger, wake up, cry, catch cold, nurse might slip down, or heaven knows what. Then as he had to look her husband in the face, who had gone to such expense, and been so kind for her sake, and make that gentleman believe she was thoroughly happy, and, finally, as he had to keep an eye upon number 4 senior, who, as she was perfectly certain, was about in 2 minutes, to be lost forever, or trampled to pieces in the crowd. These events took place in a quiet little street leading into the Champs-Élysées, the entry of which we had almost reached by this time. The 4 detachments above described, which had been straggling a little in their passage down the street, closed up at the end of it, and stood for a moment huddled together. Number 3 Miss X began speaking to her companion, the great-grandmother. "Hush, my dear," said that old lady, looking round alarmed at her daughter. "Peak French." And she straightway began nervously to make a speech which she supposed to be in that language, but which was as much like French as Iroquois. The whole secret was out. You could read it in the grandmother's face, who was doing all she could to keep from crying, and looked as frightened as she dared to look. The 2 elder ladies had settled between them that there was going to be a general English slaughter that day, and had brought the children with them, so that they might all be murdered in company. God bless you, O women, moist-eyed and tender-hearted. In those gentle silly tears of yours there is something touches one, be they never so foolish. I don't think there were many such natural drops shed that day as those which just made their appearance in the grandmother's eyes, and then went back again, as if they had been ashamed of themselves, while the good lady and her little troop walked across the road. Think how happy she will be when night comes, and there has been no murder of English, and the brood is all nestled under her wings sound asleep, and she is lying awake thanking God that the day and its pleasures and pains are over. Whilst we were considering these things, the grandfather had suddenly elevated number 4 senior upon his left shoulder, and I saw the tartan hat of that young gentleman, and the bamboo cane which had been transferred to him, high over the heads of the crowd on the opposite side through which the party moved. After this little procession had passed away, you may laugh at it, but upon my word and conscience, Miss Smith, I saw nothing in the course of the day which affected me more after this little procession had passed away. The other came, accompanied by gun banging, flag waving, incense burning, trumpets pealing, drums rolling, and at the close, received by the voice of 600 choristers, sweetly modulated to the tones of 1500 of fiddlers. Then you saw horse and foot, jackboots and bearskin, cuirass and bayonet, National Guard and line, marshals and generals all over gold, smart aides de camp galloping about like mad, and I in the midst of all, riding on his golden buckler, Solomon in all his glory, forsooth imperial Caesar, with his crown over his head, laurels and standards waving about his gorgeous chariot, and a million of people looking on in wonder and awe. His Majesty the Emperor and King reclined on his shield, with his head a little elevated. His Majesty's skull is voluminous, his forehead broad and large. We remarked that His Imperial Majesty's brow was of a yellowish color, which appearance was also visible about the orbits of the eyes. He kept his eyelids constantly closed, by which we had the opportunity of observing that the upper lids were garnished with eyelashes. Ears and climate have effected upon the face of this great monarch only a trifling alteration. We may say, indeed, that time has touched His Imperial and Royal Majesty with the lightest feather in his wing. In the nose of the conqueror of Austerlitz we remarked very little alteration. It is of the beautiful shape which we remember it possessed 25 years since, ere unfortunate circumstances induced him to leave us for a while. The nostril and the tube of the nose appear to have undergone some slight alteration, but in examining a beloved object the eye of affection is perhaps too critical. Vive l'Empereur! The soldier of Marengo is among us again. His lips are thinner, perhaps, than they were before. How white his teeth are! You can just see three of them pressing his underlip, and pray remark the fullness of his cheeks, and the round contour of his chin. Oh, those beautiful white hands! Many a time have they patted the cheek of poor Josephine, and played with the black ringlets of her hair. She is dead now, and cold, poor creature, and so are Hortense and bold Eugene, than whom the world never saw a courtier knight, as was said of King Arthur Sir Lancelot. What a day would it have been for those three could they have lived until now, and seen their hero returning? Where's Ney? His wife sits looking out from M. Flahaut's window yonder, but the bravest of the brave is not with her. Muir too is absent. Honest Joachim loves the Emperor at heart, and repents that he was not at Waterloo. Who knows but that at the sight of the handsome swordsman those stubborn English, a nail would have given way. A king, sire, is, you know, the greatest of slave state affairs of consequence. His Majesty the King of Naples is detained no doubt. When we last saw the king, however, and his highness the Prince of Olchingen, they looked to have as good health as ever they had in their lives, and we heard each of them calmly calling out higher, as they have done in numberless battles before. Is it possible? Can the emperor forget? We don't like to break it to him, but has he forgotten all about the farm at Pizzo, and the garden of the observatory? Yes, truly. There he lies on his golden shield, never stirring, never so much as lifting his eyelids, or opening his lips any wider. O vanitas vanitatum! Here is our sovereign in all his glory, and they fired 1,000 guns at Cherbourg, and never woke him. However, we are advancing matters by several hours, and you must give just as much credence as you please to the subjoined remarks concerning the procession, seeing that your humble servant could not possibly be present at it, being bound for the church elsewhere. Programs, however, have been published of the affair, and your Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.